loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we continue our coverage of Hurricane Michael's catastrophic impact on Florida. We'll be talking to someone from the panhandle of Florida. But then we'll also talk about how Cuba, unlike the United States and certainly unlike the state of Florida, prepares for hurricanes. We're going to look at how the two countries and the two systems handle these kind of natural disasters. And then today we continue our weekly series called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, days after Special Counsel Robert Mueller's appointment, he was drawn into a heated dispute between Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and then Acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe over who would ultimately oversee the investigation. McCabe argued that Rosenstein's memo justifying the firing of former FBI Director James Comey implicated him in a potential obstruction of justice case against President Trump. McCabe lost that fight and was later fired. A Bloomberg story about Chinese efforts to clandestinely install spy chips in U.S. computers appears to be fake news. Meanwhile, a senior Chinese intelligence official was arrested in a sting operation and extradited yesterday to the United States to face espionage charges. Yan Junzhu, a deputy division director in the Ministry of State Security, is the first Chinese intelligence officer ever to be extradited to face trial in open court. He's accused of trying to procure intelligence related to the design of jet engine fan blades. Then the U.S. military has grounded its entire fleet of F-35 fighter jets in the wake of a crash last month in South Carolina. The F-35 has been dogged by cost overruns, poor performance, and engineering problems virtually since its inception. And then U.S. intelligence services apparently have intercepts of Saudi government communications indicating that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered the kidnapping of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who has been missing for more than a week since entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Turkish officials believe that Khashoggi was murdered and dismembered inside the consulate. The Saudis are denying any wrongdoing. And finally, federal court judges are balking at what they call unlawful efforts by U.S. immigration authorities to continue to detain people charged with entering the country unlawfully, even after they have been granted bail. The rulings complicate the Trump administration's so-called zero-tolerance policy against defendants charged with crossing the border illegally. And in other headlines, murder victim Matthew Shepard will be interred at the Washington National Cathedral on October 26th, according to a statement by his family. Shepard was brutally murdered for being gay in 1998 in a case that made national headlines and led to a wave of outrage about the violence that the LGBTQ community faces, as well as public support for measures to address hate crimes. Rallies were held across Brazil last night against far-right presidential frontrunner Jair Bolsonaro. Bolsonaro frequently expresses his support for the military dictatorship that ruled Brazil in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and the protests last night were titled Dictatorship Never Again. Brazilians will vote in a runoff election on October 28th between Bolsonaro and Workers' Party candidate Fernando Haddad. Following the plunge in the U.S. stock market yesterday, Donald Trump once again criticized the Federal Reserve. Trump said, quote, "The Fed is going wild. They're raising interest rates and it's ridiculous," unquote. Adding that, quote, "The Fed is going loco," unquote. While the Federal Reserve has moved over the past year to normalize monetary policy by raising interest rates, Trump has protested that this will lead to a decline in GDP growth rates. The government of Malaysia has announced that it is abolishing the death penalty. This measure, praised by human rights advocates, gives relief to approximately 1,200 people on death row in that country. The newly elected government of Mahathir Mohamad has raised hopes for the expansion of civil liberties and democratic rights in Malaysia. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the impact of Hurricane Michael. It slammed into Panama City, Florida yesterday as a Category 4 hurricane with winds of 155 miles per hour before moving inland to Georgia and South Carolina. Two people are dead and more than 800,000 are without electricity. Hurricanes are getting stronger and more frequent. That's a fact of climate change. But can governments and citizens keep up? Or is there a desire or will by governments to keep up? We're joined from Tallahassee, Florida by Shelby Shoup. She is a student activist at Florida State University. She was in the center of the hurricane yesterday. And later in the segment, we'll be joined from New York City by Gail Walker. She's the executive director of Pastors for Peace. Shelby Shoup, welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. Shelby, we talked to you yesterday. We recorded the interview a little bit before noon or around noon, and that was right before you anticipated the hurricane would be like really hitting with full force where you are. Again, what's happened? Let's talk about, start with yourself. Do you have electricity?
No, we don't have any power. And from the looks of it, we're probably not going to have power for a while. Just in the apartment complex I'm in alone, it meets on the intersection of these two streets. The main street is blocked by three trees. Some of them just like, it's like half of them peeled off the top. And I don't know if you know, but Tallahassee is really renowned for these large canopied trees. It's really like a miracle that none of the houses here got hurt. Me and my friend actually pulled like a half of a tree, like huge branch off of this person's car yesterday outside the complex.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then on the other street, totally bisected by a tree that's fallen over. Like at least on the other one, we can kind of navigate around it, although definitely not safe to drive for a while. But the other one, like, can't get through without a chainsaw, which we don't have.
I heard another radio network this morning. They were talking to somebody. I don't know if it's exactly where you were, but they said it didn't sound like a storm. It sounded like a bomb when it hit. In other words, where they were, at least, I don't know if they were in Panama City. But anyway, what did it feel like when it came ashore?
You know, so honestly, we got kind of lucky, right? It veered just, I'd say, about 80 miles west of Tallahassee. We certainly didn't have the storm infrastructure to, you know, withstand 150-mile, per hour winds. But when I say lucky, that's obviously, you know, not entirely true because, you know, Panama City and Mexico City Beach just got just devastated, just absolutely ravaged. And I'm sure that they have even less secure storm infrastructure than us.
Yeah, I think the person I was listening to was from Panama City in Mexico. Is it Mexico City Beach? Is that the name of the town?
I think it's Mexico Beach, excuse me.
Mexico Beach, yeah.
Panama City and Mexico Beach. But yeah, the rumors that I've heard from Panama City is that there's a high school there. I think it's Rutherford High School, which was acting as a shelter. The roof just got totally blown off. I know that one hospital got hit by a tornado.
Yeah, there were supposed to be at least three tornadoes that were spun off from this hurricane. At least three that touched down anyway.
Yeah, and I'm looking at some of the images from Panama City. Panama City, by the way, is Panama City, Florida, on the Florida Panhandle. Shelby Shoup, our guest, is in Tallahassee. It's 80 miles east of Panama City is where you are?
Yes, we are east.
The images show complete and utter devastation. I mean, it really does look like these buildings. It looks like these buildings were in Syria, you know, like the parts of Syria that were heavily bombed. It's unbelievably devastating. And of course, those people, I would guess, Shelby, also don't have power and probably won't have power for a long time.
Yeah, that's even if they, you know, still have homes that are livable.
Well, you know, the video this morning on CNN showed that those oceanfront homes or Gulf front homes and then homes going back three or four lots were just gone.
Yeah, they're
gone. The wind just took them. They don't exist anymore.
Here we have the Trump administration, Shelby, and a lot of people inside the Trump administration, but it's not just the Republicans and it's not just Trump. But Trump in particular is saying, hey, the environment is fabulous. Climate is fabulous. No problem. And meanwhile, piece by piece, escalating the ending of any sort of even minor regulations that inhibited pollution or put some kind of controls on corporate entities. At the same time, you have the UN climate change report written with extreme and utter urgency by 6,000 scientists who participated, saying the world is coming to a tipping point, that there has to be urgent action to reduce carbon emissions because these extreme weather events like the hurricane you're experiencing, it's going to intensify. It's not just a one-off. Anyway, what's your take on some of that?
You know, there's really, the way I look at it is, Pat, we are faced with a really, really dire choice. We have two paths ahead of us. We're either heading for, global revolution. You know, we radically transform society. We dismantle and abolish capitalism. We move to socialism, the next stage of human society. Or we head for global mass extinction. And of course, that mass extinction, when I say mass, that obviously includes, the people who the billionaires, the trillionaires, who can afford to escape, who can afford not only, to evacuate our towns now. Like, for example, I know that there was a hurricane warning in Hawaii a month or two ago, and flights to LAX were $10,000, right? But they can afford to evacuate now, but can also possibly we have people like Elon Musk talking about planetary colonization, stuff like that. They will be able to survive the effects of climate apocalypse and eco-fascism, and we, the masses, will not, unless we radically change things now, unless we get organized now.
Let me ask you, too. Much was made on the news, the mainstream media, that this storm took a lot of people by surprise. At least there was less time with this storm than with previous major hurricanes to get people evacuated. And so as a result, many people were not evacuated. Tell us what the government has done for you and for other Floridians in the run-up to this storm, and what the government is preparing to do or offering to do now that the storm's already hit.
So, I would agree with that. I didn't hear about the storm. A lot of my friends have lamented we didn't hear about the storm until maybe 2 days before it happened. Yeah, I think I first heard about it on Monday. And I was like, what? Did I not hear about this? But no, that's just, how violent and volatile our weather patterns under climate change are. But, I live in Tallahassee. Andrew Mayer is our mayor. He's running for governor of Florida. Whenever I had power, he did a good job, I guess, of being on Facebook and keeping people updated or whatever. But, the Tallahassee city government and his administration, there's nothing tangible really that they have done. And I don't want to fault him. Obviously, this is a product of our state government and our national government also being wildly insufficient. I think I saw Rick Scott say something about having million cases of water or something for Floridians, but it's not, what always happens is that when government agencies or administrators do respond, it's first of all, widely accompanied by local grassroots efforts. And that really helped to get those communities that aren't as spectacular, easy for the media to cover and laud these government agents. And two, they'll stay for the immediate relief efforts, but leave, and what happens weeks later when there's still people who are homeless and displaced because we don't have free and universal housing? What happens to the people in Panama City who no longer have a hospital because we don't have free and universal health care, or we don't have, a great public transportation system that could get them to Tallahassee or get them to Pensacola, wherever they need to now for, health care? So, you said that there's two people that have died, and that is in and of itself tragic, but I'm scared for the people who are going to die in the upcoming weeks and months in the aftermath of this storm because they don't get the long-term relief that they need.
And let me add something to that, too. There was a fascinating article in the Washington Post over the weekend talking about the after effects of the last hurricane, what was it, Florence, in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Now, the Outer Banks were utterly soaked. Even the Inner Banks, completely soaked to overflowing. And as a result, there are these unprecedentedly enormous mosquitoes that scientists just have never seen before. The paper said that there were 69 different species of mosquito in North Carolina. These ones are gigantic, and it's because of all the water. And it said that West Nile virus and other viruses that are making their way north, mostly from the Caribbean, are bad enough. But with these enormous mosquitoes, the transmission of these diseases is going to be even worse. We're going to see disease outbreaks like West Nile, for example, and I forget the name of the other one that's causing problems in Florida already.
I'm glad you mentioned that, John, because there's all of these associated attendant events. Yes. We've run out of time, actually, but I want to just ask Shelby, because, again, the government isn't organized in a way to actually meet human needs or social needs. It's really designed government to facilitate profit-making by companies. But, Shelby, when you talked to us yesterday, if Rick Scott had ordered an evacuation a week ago or 4 days ago, if you had more advance notice, how would you or other people have actually left, and where would you have gone? We have 30 seconds left.
I'm not really sure if I actually would have left, because I'm glad that I'm here now in the immediate aftermath to do relief aid. But I would have certainly, you know, liked the option. I would have certainly liked to, you know, possibly buy a bus ticket before, you know, their price gouge or, you know, price surge.
You don't have a car?
No, I do not have a car.
So, like, for people who don't have cars, is the government organizing transportation to bring people to evacuation centers?
No, of course not. And, you know, it's funny that, like, you know, Uber and Lyft will give free rides to the voting polls, because now voting is, like, it's, you know, it's like the liberal replacement for an actual radical change. But they won't offer free rides to people who are trying to evacuate, who are trying to, you know, get survival supplies for a hurricane.
That says it all.
Yeah, it really does. It's insane.
Shelby Shoup, we're out of time. We want to thank you. Perhaps we'll be back to you in the coming days. We hope, of course, that you and your neighbors and family and friends are safe. But of course, this is going to be a big effort. Again, right now, the media is focused on the catastrophe. But after a few days, the media's attention will go elsewhere. And I believe the government is not organized and has not prioritized actually making sure the people in the Florida panhandle have the needs that they have be met. Anyway, Shelby Shoup, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you.
In the last part of our first segment, we're going to talk about how Cuba handles hurricanes. Cuba, like the southern states of the United States, like Florida, is frequently in the path of hurricanes. And as a consequence, and especially because it is an island nation, it must ready itself for not just the possibility, but the inevitability of hurricanes. Same with the southern states in the United States. We're joined in this segment by Gail Walker. Gail is the executive director of Pastors for Peace. She's also a Cuba solidarity activist who has been to Cuba many, many times. Gail Walker, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thanks so much, Brian. Thanks for having me.
I want to, before we talk about how Cuba responds to hurricanes and the Cuban leadership, I want to read a few words from the President of the United States about today's hurricane. Here it is. It's really, really wet and windy. Very windy. Many people are saying this is very wet and windy. Many people. Nobody understands hurricanes better than Donald Trump. Nobody. Here you have, I know it's hard not to laugh.
It's great.
I mean, here you have the President of the United States in the wake of this terrible tragedy that's befallen the people in the panhandle in the southern part of the country. And we think about how Cuba handles hurricanes and how the Cuban leadership deals with it. It's, you know, there's no comparable sort of mirroring sort of situation. But let's talk, in addition to how the leadership handles it, what's the system in Cuba? Because Cuba seems to have far fewer fatalities, even though it takes the brunt of more hurricanes and frequently hurricanes of greater strength.
Yeah, yeah. I had to gasp when you read that. I guess I hadn't heard the Donald Trump soundbite there. But really, it is a complete contrast when you think about, you know, the leadership from the president on down, the way that they are there, out there with the people, informing them ahead of time, and then with them in the aftermath. It's a much more serious life and death approach to a life and death situation. Cuba is really recognized as the example of how to prepare for a hurricane, and has indeed proven through its survival rate, that they know what they're doing. It's amazing that, you know, the last, I don't know, 17 or so hurricanes, that only a handful of deaths have occurred, in contrast to the United States, where it's just going back a few years, Hurricane Matthew, 44 people died in the U.S. and killed no one in Cuba. Katrina, you know, again, big disparaging, you know, numbers there. Gustav, Ike, you know, you go back and to these various hurricanes, and it just proven over and over again just how Cuba's approach is really is a more life-saving. Hurricane Isabel killed more in the U.S. in 2003 than six major hurricanes killed Cubans between 1996 and the year 2002. And it's all really related to a strategy that is very much, you know, all hands on deck, national program of disaster preparedness, evacuation, relief, recovery, that involves virtually every citizen from the national to the local level. And I mean, I think that that's the secret, if you will, of their success. You know, not only making sure that evacuation centers are closer to people so that people don't have to travel further away, things as simple as turning off lights and shutting down cooking gas mains when winds reach a certain speed to protect people from being electrocuted if they're in flood waters or, you know, from gas explosions. Making use of the CDR, the Committees for Defense of Revolution, you know, to really reach out, make sure that, that folk are safe and that they're that people know exactly where people are, and you know, again, that's on the very much on a local level in which there's involvement with trying to really reduce risk. So there's so many different ways that Cuba really seriously takes this approach. Almost at the close of one hurricane, they're preparing for the next. The Cuban Civil Defense, which is an organization which involves, you know, virtually everybody at the municipal level, together with the public, the health, you know, really participating with local government and institutions to be as well prepared as possible for risk assessments, but and disaster planning. So it's those kinds of things that Cuba has really done and done well, and it's recognized internationally as an expert when it comes to hurricane preparedness.
I listened to an interview with Ricardo Alarcón, former speaker of the Cuban National Assembly. It was after Hurricane Katrina, actually, and the Democrats were blaming Bush. Of course, there was a lot of blame to go around. And Alarcón made the point. He says, "Well, we don't really need to play the blame game here because it's really not simply about Bush, as bad as Bush might have been, or the head of FEMA at that time, Brownie. But it's about social organization." He said, "Our system is organized so that everyone is accounted for. Society has an obligation to every individual." Now that might be, you know, sort of strike some people weird because socialism is construed as a system that takes away individuality. But what we see in the hurricanes is that the Cuban government, as a matter of policy, makes sure that every individual is taken care of. And Alarcón was saying, "I know where my granddaughter is going to be and how she's going to get there when the next hurricane comes." Now, I'm looking at the New York Daily News from 10 years ago, and here's the headline, "Lesson from Ike." That's Hurricane Ike, a big one. "Nobody does evacuations like Cuba." And I want to read a couple quick sentences, Gail Walker, and then have you comment. "When Hurricane Ike struck Cuba, Ronald Matos didn't think twice about fleeing his one-room wooden house for a government shelter. The 34-year-old construction worker and his wife, Emma Jean, got soft beds, free meals, the attention of a doctor and solicitous social workers, and the companionship of other friendly Cubans. We passed the night talking and telling stories. He talks about there's no electricity, but we are better protected than in our homes. With an inefficient," this is the Daily News, "centralized economy and a U.S. embargo that has stifled trade, Cuba doesn't have the resources to build new hurricane-proof buildings. It doesn't have fleets of Humvees to charge through floodwaters. Few of its people," this is 10 years ago, "have cell phones to call a loved one. But there is one thing the communist island does right. It's evacuations. And in the end, that saves more lives than anything else." And, you know, again, evacuations mean a high degree of social organization, transport, and communication. That's what it really means. So even minus the technology, this kind of organization can make all the difference. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that they laid out very well. And again, it's, you know, Cuba's perspective on this, as you just rightfully said, quoting Alarcón, is that, you know, we take care of our own. We know where our people are. And I think there's a level of trust in the government that does not exist, that does not exist here. You've got a lot of people, I think, I would assume that decide to stay in their homes rather than to evacuate, perhaps thinking that they can last the storm. But also, I think there's concern about looting and about, you know, folks coming and taking their belongings. I think there's a different mindset in Cuba. The reality is that the government has been able to provide for folk and to take care of them, and that's been proven, you know, over the years of dealing with hurricanes. And so it's a whole different way of sort of looking at it from not only the government perspective, but the perspective of the citizenship as well. And it's, I think there's also a faith in the information that's being presented. So long before the hurricane hits, there's folk know, and I wish I could remember the name of the guy who's sort of the famous meteorologist, you know, that they all know by, you know, and when he's on, I mean, you know, it's like you can hear a pin drop. People are like, you know, he's speaking and, you know, he's really revered and respected, knows hurricanes, and there's a sense of faith and confidence that we're getting accurate information so that people can be moved and can be taken out of harm's way. So I think it's just a whole different way of thinking when it comes to how to prepare for a hurricane, but also how to respond to the call that, hey, this is a dangerous situation and we need to be able to move, and that there is really a complete trust within the public that, it's about doing what we can to protect lives, the most vulnerable being among them. And I think it's as simple as that. And Cuba has proven its ability to handle hurricanes and what it takes to care for people time and time again. And I really believe that at its core, that's what's going on.
Gail Walker is our guest. Yeah, people, Americans who haven't been to Cuba don't know. It's a completely, the country is operating on a different wavelength, a different set of values. Like when you leave your home, you absolutely know there's not going to be looting. You go out at night in the streets in Cuba, no matter what neighborhood you're in, you don't feel at risk. I mean, that's just the nature of the country. The issue of crime, Americans would absolutely be shocked. And it's not because there's police on every street corner or something like that. Far from it. But it's a different set of values. And the other thing in our last minute and a half here, Gail, when you look at a map of the Caribbean, you see Cuba is closer to the United States than Puerto Rico. And the old statement that Puerto Rico and Cuba are two wings of the same bird, you know, almost right next to each other. Here we just had hurricanes hitting Puerto Rico, devastating, thousands dead, people without electricity for a long period of time. And that's part of the United States. And here you have Cuba, underdeveloped economically because of the blockade and other parts of economic isolation, able to manage so much better. I mean, a real contrast in two different systems. 1 minute left.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that when you, that's a real case in point. When you look at the way that Puerto Rico was, you know, really left abandoned by the U.S. government. And then, of course, the insulting way in which Trump came down and threw out paper towels as if he was, you know, at a football sports event. Cuba approach is about, you know, saving lives. It's about doing what can be done to prepare people as best possible and to make sure that that all are cared for. And I think that, you know, simply put, that's really a major difference in the way in which the governments approach the care of their people. And the hurricane preparedness is a stark difference in the way that the two systems operate. And again, it's about saving lives, and Cuba's proven that they're up for the task. And unfortunately, that's not always the case here in the United States.
Yeah, and I just saw recently the Cubans have developed a 100-year plan to deal with global climate change and rising sea levels. And of course, the hurricanes are going to become more intense. I mean, it's amazing, a 100-year plan. They can't stop global warming, but they're trying to, you know, take long-term efforts and plans to mediate or to mitigate the impact. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from New York City by Gail Walker. Gail is the executive director of Pastors for Peace, longtime Cuba solidarity activist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the publisher of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, guys.
Hi, thanks for having us, John.
Let's begin with breaking news. Washington State's Supreme Court today just threw out the death penalty, saying that the death penalty is unconstitutional and there will be no more death penalty in the state of Washington. Paul, you have some familiarity with Washington. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I have to say is that, frankly, I find this, you know, very almost stunning, and I think also a credit to, I think, how far the court in Washington has moved, because I was in prison in Washington for 17 years and followed the Washington Supreme Court with, very closely. And one of the things that was interesting is that for the 80s and indeed much of the 90s, the pattern in Washington was that defendants would be convicted of capital murder, they'd be sentenced to death, they received the mandatory review in the Washington Supreme Court, which almost uniformly upheld the death sentences. And then almost as uniformly, as soon as those cases reached federal court and their attorneys made the argument in federal court that the constitutional rights of the defendants had been violated, almost without exception, the federal courts reversed the convictions of the Washington State death sentence prisoners. And it got so bad that at one point, one justice, Robert Utter, resigned from the Washington Supreme Court, citing the fact that their death penalty jurisprudence was basically a sick, unconstitutional joke because they kept upholding these death sentences that were later found to be unconstitutional. And one of the things that had been attributed to was the political pressure on elected judges to uphold the death sentence. So the fact that within a 20 or 25 year period, the Washington Supreme Court has held that the Washington death penalty is unconstitutional is, you know, frankly, I think it's an amazing feat, not just so much for the legal ramifications, but also the political ones. The fact that the judges were courageous enough to actually vote, I think, on what the law demanded, because it's not like the Washington death penalty got any worse or any better in the last 20 or 30 years. It's been the same. It's been just as arbitrary. It's been as unevenly racially applied depending on the race of the victims and the race of the defendants. So in some respects, it's just, you know, it's definitely a decision whose day has come. And you know, definitely good for the Washington Supreme Court in having reached this decision.
Just as an aside, and before I ask a follow-up question, there was a case in Washington State a few years ago where a man who had been sentenced to death and who was grossly, morbidly obese had exhausted his appeals. And so it was execution time. In Washington State, though, the prisoner chooses his method of execution for himself, and he chose death by hanging. Well, the prison system, the doctors there, determined that he couldn't be hanged because he was so fat, it would cause his head to pop off. And that was considered by the courts to be cruel and unusual as a form of execution. And so his execution had to be stayed permanently. They couldn't force him to go to, let's say, the gas chamber, the electric chair, get the chemicals in his veins. And it just showed how ridiculous, how preposterous this entire system is. Now, more importantly, and this is my follow-up question to you, Paul, you talked a moment ago about the death penalty in Washington State being unevenly applied based on racial discrimination, really. We see that all across the country. Do you think that this decision is going to be a model for other state Supreme Courts that have the same kinds of problems that they're facing with these racial disparities in sentencing?
You know, I don't know about that, because frankly, the fact that anyone, that any justice, state or federal, allows the death penalty to continue in this country, given the well-documented disparities of race and class. And yeah, and I think class is also an important factor too, because I don't think that anyone can point to a single rich person that's ever been sentenced to death, much less executed.
You're right.
You know, and I was on a panel a couple of years ago with a lawyer named Ron Tabak. He's an expert on the death penalty and really great guy. And we're having that discussion, and he's literally studied every execution in the United States since 1900. And I asked him about that. I said, you know, so Ron, have any wealthy people ever been executed? And he thought about it for a while, and around 20 minutes later, he tells me, you know, the closest I could think of is the Rosenbergs.
Yeah. They weren't wealthy. They were poor people. Or Leopold and Loeb, maybe. That's how far back we have to go.
Yeah, but they weren't executed.
Yeah, they weren't executed. That's right.
Yeah, they were sent to life in prison. You know, so I think that's one of the things. One of his last opinions, you know, I think Justice Harry Blackmun, finally, after like 20 years on the bench, you know, he wrote that I will no longer tinker with the machinery of death. And, you know, I think that the problem with the death penalty in this country, I think, for the last 400 years or however long we've had it, is that no one's really been able to figure out how to impose a death penalty in a fair manner. It's, you know, at the end of the day, it's just been filled and riven with biases, whether against racial minorities, whether against the poor, certainly against the poor. And, you know, it's just been one of those things. So rather than just say, hey, look, this is just something that we can't do, let's move on. And to an extent, I think it's also tainted by the American history of slavery. And you know, that legacy seems to just permeate everything in our criminal justice system, whether we want it to or not. And rather than just take the step that pretty much every industrialized country, I think at this point, I think Japan is the only other industrialized country that still executes its citizens. I think, you know, even the Russians have given up on the death penalty. And China, interestingly enough, has also made reforms that are slowly but surely cutting down on the number of citizens that they execute. And I think that, you know, everywhere else in the world, industrialization and the rule of law and increasing constitutional norms, pretty much in every country that does it, basically shows the slow decline of the death penalty, and that eventually someone makes the political decision, look, we've just got to get rid of it. And I think it's interesting is that in Europe, most of the ruling class in Europe decided by the 60s and 70s that having the death penalty was totally at odds with the notion of civilized society. And it was the ruling class that decided to get rid of the death penalty when it was still really politically popular among the voters and among the electorate.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not popular now, because that's the thing, is that people's consciousness changes as the laws change and as the practices change. Paul, finish out, and then I want to ask Kevin Gustala a follow-up question.
No, I was just going to say that in Europe, it's interesting is that, you know, when they abolished the death penalty in most European countries in the 60s and 70s, it was hugely popular among the electorate. The ruling class and political leaders took a very decisive step in banning it. And now I think it's interesting that anyone across the political spectrum that even remotely suggests bringing back the death penalty or reimposing the death penalty, even when there's horrific political offenses or terrorist attacks or whatever, they rightly get laughed out of the room as you know, some type of crazy barbarian. It's like, no, civilized societies don't kill their citizens.
Let's have Kevin Gustala jump in. That was Paul Wright. Paul is talking to us from Lake Worth, Florida. He is the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center, the publisher of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News. Kevin Gustala is a writer for Shadowproof.com. We're talking to Kevin from Chicago and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin, what also jumps out at me is that, you know, up until the state of Washington just apparently banned the death penalty, there were 31 states. Now there are 30 states where the death penalty is legal. So in addition to race and class of the victim or of the accused, a lot depends on where you are. I mean, there's that kind of arbitrariness about who gets put to death. It seems that it would seem to me on that basis alone, you could demand, or we should demand, the absolute abolition of a death penalty, a punishment that can't be taken back, can't be remediated. there's no solution for the accused after that fact. But if you're in one state, if you're in Alabama or Mississippi, your outcome is far different than if you're in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I think geography is very important. It wasn't long ago that the Connecticut Supreme Court actually moved to finalize the abolition of their death penalty. And something that I remember reading, and I have it up here as a reference, is that the Justice Palmer in Connecticut was looking at the geography, and it's very instructive. I mean, what Paul was mentioning about the legacy of slavery and everything. I mean, the states that have carried out the most executions over the past four decades are Confederate states. And if you add in Oklahoma and Arizona, which were not states when there was the Civil War, they weren't states yet, that would bring the total of executions to around 85-90% probably. We're looking at mostly southern states being the ones that insist on continuing capital punishment. And that makes sense because we've seen some of these battles, particularly in Oklahoma, over being able to continue the death penalty, even though they're having trouble getting supplies of drugs to execute those prisoners, even though you're running into problems with pharmaceutical companies that don't want to provide their medicine for executions, especially if those companies end up having any roots in Europe. They don't want their drugs to be used to kill people. So that's been something that has been a very real reality. You have the fact that nearly two-thirds of executions, if you go back to 1976, are performed in only five states.
Incredible.
And of course, Texas making up almost 40% of the executions in this country. And I remember that when the Bushes were governor, there was this big deal about a sort of like informal competition that they were trying to see who could execute the most people, whether it was, you know, Florida or Texas, which had really high rates of capital punishment. And all the time, what is concluded when you look at these decisions to abolish the death penalty is that there's racial disparities, or you've got the issue of people being placed on death row, but never knowing when they're going to be put to death, and not even certain that they ever will be put to death, which is a form of cruel and unusual punishment in and of itself, and has had led the judges to actually decide that that makes it unconstitutional.
In fact, in California, you're far more likely to die of disease or old age on death row than you are to be executed.
Or suicide.
Or suicide, that's right, which happens all the time in American prisons.
You know, when you look at who gets the death penalty, I'm looking at some of the statistics. The race of defendants executed in the United States since 1976, when the death penalty came back, it had been abolished.
Gary Gilmore.
Yep. 34% of the defendants on death row, or those who have been executed, were Black. 8% were Latino. 55% were white. 1.6% other. So Black people, who constitute about 12-13% of the population, made up more than one-third of the people executed.
I was just going to say is it's actually worse than that, because basically Black men are, of that one-third, Black men are like almost all of the people being executed, and Black men constitute 6% of the population. So when you frame it by race and gender, it's an even more striking disparity.
Okay, excellent. Good point. Race of victims since 1976. If you were if you're on death row, here's the statistics. Only 15% of the victims of a capital crime, only 15% were Black, 6% were Latino, 75% were white. So the race of the victim seems to matter a great deal, Kevin. It seems like it's maybe almost the determining factor.
Yes, and I think, you know, to add to that, I would say that we would look at the whole context of the criminal justice system, or injustice system, if you will, because when you look at the beginning of how you are pressured to accept a plea, how you're not supposed to go to trial, lack of resources forces you into accepting a plea, or maybe you're coerced into confessing to a crime that you didn't commit. I mean, we had a ton of wrongful death or wrongful conviction cases. It's epidemic in this country, and those people face the potential of being executed and many of them have been executed in our history. And so when you just look at that and the racial disparity of that, of how those people are forced into accepting these agreements and they plead to these crimes, okay, now you're ending up on death row and you face the potential of being executed. And when you look at that dimension, I think it makes it even more dire, and you see why it's so necessary to abolish the death penalty.
There's another statistic here, John, called interracial murders. That is, if the defendant is white and the victim is black or vice versa. White defendants who killed black people, who were convicted of killing black people, the number of people executed since 1976, that was 42 years ago, the number of white people executed for killing black people would be 20.
Oh, my gosh.
The number of black defendants who killed a white victim would be 289.
Oh, my goodness.
So you can't look at these raw numbers, and the raw numbers don't tell you everything for sure, but you can't look at the numbers without discerning patterns here, Paul Wright. And clearly the pattern of race for defendants or for victims, or is a white person kill a black person or a black person kill a white person, all of these things make a great deal of difference in terms of whether an individual is going to be sentenced to death.
Well, and I think the other thing too is also comes up is that now one of the jokes I hear among my friends who are criminal defense attorneys is when they say that the only thing that the death penalty in America is good at doing is determining who's got the best lawyer or who's got the better lawyer.
Yeah.
And that's a huge issue too, is the lack of adequate defense counsel in a number of states. Alabama is one of them. There's no federal public defender for capital cases in Alabama. It's literally been a private nonprofit. The Equal Justice Initiative is basically, or the lawyers that provide counsel for death row prisoners in Alabama. And you see this time and time again, is that, you know, prisoners that are accused of, or defendants that are accused of capital offenses, typically they aren't provided inadequate, and they're poor. Typically they're not being provided with inadequate legal defense, either at trial or on appeal. And until recently, in some of these states, the maximum amount of money that a lawyer could be paid by the state to represent a defendant in a capital appeal was like $500. And yeah, this is something where these are the most complex of all criminal cases, and literally someone's life is on the line. And the government's position was, well, $500 is enough to adequately compensate a lawyer for a death penalty case.
Under the Clinton administration, we had what was called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. That was after the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City by a white man. A lot of people were killed, a lot of adults and a lot of children were killed. The response was the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, and it basically took away the right of death row inmates, even using the explanation of innocence or new evidence about innocence, their right to come back to court. Talk about that if you would.
Federal habeas corpus, to begin with, was, even before ADEPA was passed by Bill Clinton, basically it was extremely difficult for criminal defendants to win a federal habeas appeal. By the time people were getting to the federal appellate courts with a habeas corpus petition, odds were slim indeed. But a lot of what was happening is politicians of both political parties were upset by the fact that federal judges were finding any constitutional violations at all and setting aside death sentences and occasionally reversing criminal convictions. And so they passed ADEPA. And what this did is this set the standard, was that the only basis that a federal court could have for reversing a criminal conviction once a case got that far was if the state courts that had reviewed the decision had unreasonably applied U.S. Supreme Court precedent. And that's a really tough standard to meet. And basically, there weren't a lot of habeas corpus cases being won by criminal defendants to begin with, and now kind of locked it in so that there's even fewer. It also had provisions in there for speeding up the review process in terms of how quickly the federal courts would review cases, and the judges have kind of largely ignored that, and I think that has more to do with they want to manage their dockets more than rather than have, you know, Congress tell them how quickly they need to decide or not decide cases. But it's been one of those things, though, where ADEPA has literally ensured that federal courts can't review federal criminal sentences. I was one of the people that was affected by that law as well. And the other thing that also gets a lot of, that doesn't get much notice these days, is that the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act also singled out immigration detainees to preclude the federal courts from reviewing their claims as well. So it wasn't just criminal defendants that Clinton savaged with this law, but it was also immigration detainees as well. So, and unfortunately, here we are 22 years later, and amidst all the talk about criminal justice reform and that, no one of any political party is talking about repealing the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. No one's talked about repealing or modifying the Prison Litigation Reform Act or the 1994 Violent Crime Act, which massively expanded the federal death penalty, took away Pell Grants, and was otherwise a pretty bad thing for the entire criminal justice system in this country. So I think that's just something to keep in mind when we hear about people, politicians talking about criminal justice reform, is no one's talking about dismantling, you know, the superstructure that has basically built the modern police state of mass incarceration in this country, which was, at the federal level, was largely erected by Bill Clinton when he was president.
Yeah. Kevin Gustala, go ahead.
So I wanted to quickly address this point, because during the primary, the Democratic primary in 2016, Hillary Clinton was actually asked by a black man, Ricky Jackson, who was wrongfully convicted of murder and spent 39 years in prison, how she could continue to support the death penalty. And obviously everything that Paul's just said is important context for why she should have to justify continuing to support this law, which has had such a pernicious effect. And in fact, the way that she justified continuing to support this is, you know, invoking the war on terrorism and invoking September 11th attacks. And to the face of this man who was wrongfully convicted and had gone through so much hardship, basically said, this was her quote, "At this point, given the challenges we face from terrorist activities, primarily in our own country, that end up under federal jurisdiction for very limited purposes, I think that it can still be held in reserve for those." So basically, she was not willing to take any steps to abolish the death penalty because it might not allow for sentencing terrorist suspects or terrorism people who perpetrate those acts to death. And that's incredible to me, because basically she's willing to defend the vast injustice of the system just so that maybe less than 1% of people could still be executed if necessary. And it's incredible. And it also shows such hubris to not address the role that you've played in actually perpetrating so much injustice.
That's the voice of Kevin Gustala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com. He's the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. We're talking to Kevin from Chicago. We're also talking with Paul Wright from Lake Worth, Florida. He is the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the publisher of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You know, let's switch topics. We don't have that much more. I wanted to ask one of you, at least, to comment about this cop, talk about the death penalty, this cop who gave the death penalty to Tamir Rice, 12-year-old in Cleveland, just rolled up on the playground where Tamir Rice had a play gun. He's a 12-year-old, and you can see the video for yourself. He rolls up. He waits about 0.5 seconds and just blasts Tamir Rice, blows him away. Then they tackle his sister, who's trying to come to his aid. Tamir Rice was still alive, bleeding to death. The police did nothing. This cop, Timothy Lehman, has just been hired by another police department in Ohio. So he's not charged. Nothing happens to him legally. The Cleveland police, though, do fire him. And now he's a cop again, Paul Wright.
And I think this is actually kind of the norm, is that, you know, police and prison guards routinely kill and murder people. And not only is there no repercussions in the sense of, you know, they're not criminally charged. They're not, you know, not only they're not criminally charged, but they're also sometimes they're fired, which that's almost kind of unusual in this case, is the fact that he was actually fired. But then typically they get rehired. It's not a thing of like, oh, we can't get jobs anymore. One of the things that's interesting is we publish our magazine, Prison Legal News, and all of our back issues are available on our website, prisonlegalnews.org. And a couple of months ago, we got a takedown request from a guard who we had reported in the magazine that he'd been fired for beating a prisoner to death in Michigan. And he was contacting us, telling us that the story kept coming up on Google searches and was making it hard for him to get a job as a jail guard.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if this is the definition of chutzpah or what, but... you know, it's kind of like one of those things of, you know, he asked us literally, will you please take down this article? It's making me hard to get a job. And the only thing I was kind of surprised about was that, you know, potential employers actually cared enough that, you know, being fired for beating someone to death was considered, you know, a potential red flag in terms of hiring him. But generally speaking, people are not being held accountable. They aren't permanently disqualified from the positions.
You know, actually, this police officer, Timothy, he withdrew his application because the Black Lives Matter movement there was challenging his hiring. And so it looks like he's not going to be a police officer with the Bel Air Police Department, was where he was trying to get hired.
That's important. And it also shows that what people do, what the movement does, what Black Lives Matter does in this case actually makes a difference.
Kevin, I want to turn to a different issue. There was an article in Criminal Legal News, one of Paul's two fantastic magazines, about efforts by Walmart to felonize shoplifting. Now, every state has a different law as to the value of an item stolen that makes it either a misdemeanor or a felony. In Virginia, for example, it's $250, which is quite low. You know, you break into a car and you steal cell phone, just one cell phone. That's a felony because a cell phone is likely worth more than $250. But Walmart is working with state legislatures to lower that limit rather than raise it to make petty shoplifting a felony. Talk about that.
This is something it reminds me of what we talked about a couple of weeks back, where we had Rent-A-Center, you know, working with officers to make it easier to go after and criminalize people because they haven't been able to pay for their dryers or their washers or whatever. They've fallen, they're derelict on their payment plan. I mean, in this case, basically, you've got these sort of crimes where we don't know exactly, but they could be crimes of survival. Maybe somebody's stealing something because they need to get by. We don't know what people are stealing in this case. It doesn't matter in any way. You could become a felon for the shoplifting. If it is something that they don't need, they're still becoming felons because they've stolen this property, and that's going to follow them for the rest of their life. And we should just, you know, I guess in this moment right now, very quickly, while everyone's mind is on the midterm elections, becoming a felon in many of the states in the U.S. means you're not going to be able to vote. And there's just so much more of your life that's going to change. And the fact that a big box store would work with the officers to do this, as much as it reflects a culture that is just a way of life in this country and has been, it's just so pernicious and evil because it can have such a lasting impact on people.
We are out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. Kevin's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the publisher of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming in the next hour.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.